Ladies and gentlemen, we are live broadcasting from the famous Seattle Comedy Underground, providing the Pacific Northwest with live comedy performances 7 nights a week for over 30 years. I'm Joe Hicks. This is the Tight 60 Podcast. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, local comedian, and manager of the Comedy Underground, Mr. James Milton.
Good afternoon to you, and good afternoon to you all.
All right, and tonight, our very special guest has been voted 2014's fastest rising star, has been seen on Conan and America's Got Talent. Latest comedy album, I believe, Get Funny or Die Trying, available on iTunes, and recently completed over 1,000 consecutive nights of comedy performances. And last but not least, headlining the Comedy Underground here in Seattle this weekend, Mr. Sammy Obaid.
Thank you so much. You missed a few things. Just kidding. That was a lot. That was a lot of stuff I did.
Well, bring it at me.
Whoa, that gave me a headache myself just listening to it.
Yeah, it's quite a resume.
Well, yeah, and I'm curious about this 1,000 consecutive comedy performance. Is that 1,000 days in a row that you went up?
It was 1,000. I'm going to tell you guys a secret. It was 1,002.
Wow.
Not so too many people know about this except this network that we've established here.
Right. So four listeners.
So James's family, I'm letting you guys know. Just between, I didn't even tell my own family. I did 1,002 days.
Wow.
And
so that works out to like almost four years in a row?
No. It's 2¾ years. Almost okay. On the nose. 2¾. Exactly.
So 365 days a year for 2.5 years, you went up and you did. Were these book shows or did you just like race out there and go to every mic you could find?
A little bit of both. Needed the open mics. There was, I wouldn't say it would be impossible to have done it without open mics. But it would have required a lot more setting shows up out of scratch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, there's a lot of nights in some of these towns across America that only have an open night, no show, you know. And there's some nights where no shows want to let you on.
So were you traveling the whole time then?
Was I what?
Traveling the whole time for this?
Well, I would say about 75% of the streak was done in California.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was a lot of times where I was just in one area. But I was definitely moving in different parts of California all the time.
You're also doing, you do a lot of college gigs, right? So, because I remember
I started
you on
doing
Twitter
colleges.
You were doing stuff.
Yeah.
You still do stuff all over.
I still do stuff, but that didn't start till the last 100 days of the streak.
Okay. What was your biggest, did you have any worries of something impeding that once you got to a point to where you were like, hey, I can do this, and then God forbid, you know, a rental car company isn't open on a certain day that you can't get to a gig, or, I don't know, you get a DUI, or anything like that?
Was I afraid that something like that would happen?
Yeah, something sort of circumstances beyond your control.
I mean, everything you just named pretty much happened at some point.
nice.
Pretty much on. That sounds like you read my blog and asked the exact things that happened, because that's everything that happened. It was terrifying to be in that experience, but I wouldn't think about it like when that wasn't happening. Like when I'd just be going day to day, like, yep, today's today. Just got to do today, mm-hmm. handle today. What's my plan for today?
So but you're then, in a sort of 12-step program.
Yeah. Like, all the times that shit happened, it was unexpected. Mm. That's why it happened, because, can I curse?
It's just, absolutely. Rip. Let it rip.
Yeah, yeah. That's all the time that, yeah, shit happened because, like, I would prepare very well. I'd have alternate scenarios all the time. Mm. So the only reason why something wouldn't work out is because shit would happen, like getting pulled over for a DUI, or, you know, some booker not letting me on the show, or a show getting canceled, or losing my ID at a rental car shop, like all these things. Mm-hmm. When they happened, it was terrifying. But, yeah, otherwise, I was just, you know, just kind of focusing on day to day.
And I'm confused. So you did get a DUI? Is that what I take?
No, I did not get a DUI. That story had a very happy ending.
Oh, but you did get pulled over.
I mean, happy, depending on how you look at it.
Or
depends
literally.
On how you look. If you're the law and you think justice is the end result, then you're probably not happy about that.
Yeah.
But I was drunk driving and I got away with it.
Well, now did you say, look, officer, I'm on day 981.
That's right. I'm
I need
there,
this.
Man.
I was actually on day 170.
Wow.
178. So, but I didn't tell them. They had no idea. Mm. But you know, 178, they'd be like, ah, you can start again. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, was this some kind of, I'm just curious, was this some kind of like a Guinness World Record, or was this just like a personal?
You're in the books, right?
No, I'm not. It should have been. If there was justice in the world, if I got that DUI, then there would have been this in the Guinness Book of World. I guess that was the trade-off, because I applied, and they were like, they're first of all like, did you mean you want to do the longest-running comedy show like the Laugh Factory did for 72 hours? No, that's not what I meant.
Yeah.
Then they're like, okay, well, if you're going to prove this thing that goes on, because back then I was only trying to do it 365 days.
Uh-huh.
This was in the middle of that. It was like day 200-something. They're like, if you want that, we have to send out a guy, one of our certified Guinness appraisers, to come out and monitor you and take measurements uh-huh. every day, and they have to stay with you forever during the whole thing. So you have to find a place for them to live. And you
oh,
have
the expense. I was going to say. So who funds that?
You have to pay them £50,000 a year. That
means, which is 100 grand a year,
yes,
almost.
Exactly. So 100 grand a year for however long I want to do it, which at this time was just 1 year. But still, I didn't have that money. I had no money.
Yeah.
I was eating peanut butter out of a jar.
Yeah.
Doing open mics.
And if you did, I think at that point, I would also have him do other tasks besides monitor my performance,
yeah,
i.e. drive me to all my gigs.
Sure, yeah.
You will clean my apartment.
Yeah.
Pick up some coffee.
That's cool. So that was basically out of the question. That's impossible to
No, well, I mean, it's possible now. Like, if I wanted to do it again now, I have the funding to make that happen. But mm-hmm. back then, it was physically impossible.
So is it some sort of
someone?
Would that be like an undocumented world record then, or is there some
type? It's an underground.
Okay,
it's an urban legend. That's all it is.
Hey, I saw on your blog, SammyKO.com, I believe is the website. The latest post was about joke thievery. Was that
Yes, that was me.
Was that inspired by a personal experience?
By all of my personal experience. You know, it took a lot of years to gather everything that I put into that post. And the post... it was less inspired by like seeing someone do a stolen joke, more inspired by comics always going around calling other comics hacks.
Huh.
That's really what fueled the post, if anything, because it happens so often. And like, I never call anybody a hack because I don't really care that much. And secondly, like, it's everybody has borrowed something from somewhere, whether unintentionally or intentionally, at some point in their comedy career. So it's just kind of hypocritical, I think. But it's done all the time. So it's like I listen to other, you know, it's like we're always talking shit about other comedians. And so I'm like, well, you know, but we've never had like an explicit, like actual listing manual. How do you know what are the different categories of it? Because there's different ways of stealing jokes from people, and we see them all the time. We don't really think about them as much.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to kind of just write about that whole thing in one long post. And my hopes is just like, you know, people found it interesting and newer comics read it and just kind of realize. Like, I think that the best way, like, it's like, you know, everybody wants to have fun, original material. So it's like, it's fun for everybody when everybody comes up with it. Like, so like, I just want people to, you know, just be like, it's okay to try shit. Just get out there and don't care what other people think.
Well, have you ever had that?
Do drugs. do lots of fucking drugs.
Surprising second piece of advice to that.
Yeah, and drop out of school.
You have to earn their trust first. That's the whole thing.
Have you ever had that personal experience then where you've seen somebody go up there and do blatantly like one of your bits?
I've seen people, and I've had a suspicion that something that they said was similar to something that I'd said before and that they had been influenced by me, but it was never blatant enough for me to make a scene, like to confront anybody about it.
Do you think in general that there is a lot of joke thievery, or is it more of a gray area? Because, I mean, I've noticed just... by being watching a lot of shows and being in a comedy environment that, you know, say someone has a joke about those five web toe shoes.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon, three or four people have a joke about the five web toe shoes.
Yeah, right.
And it's maybe not the same joke per se, but those other people weren't doing it until that guy did it. So, you know, is that joke thievery or are people, because, you know, there was that whole era, everyone had the, you know, I thought the guy was crazy, but he's wearing a Bluetooth joke. And so you get into these fads or sort of genre-based.
Well, I think personally part of that is the less original a premise is, the more likely it is that other people have similar premises.
Yeah.
You know? So
that's so basically in the post, I just said there's three levels. The first level is you write a joke that someone else has, but you didn't know they had that joke or you didn't know they had that premise. That's level one. That happens a lot. It just means that someone else thought of the same thing as you, which means it wasn't like the most possible original thing, but it's not a big deal because maybe you're trying to talk about something topical, you know? Mm-hmm. And then level two is when you definitely heard someone else do it, but you forgot or you unintentionally started writing about it.
Okay.
And that happens a lot too. Very, very common. And then level three is hearing the person do it and with their punchline and basically taking that, copying that and doing it intentionally. Whether it be like you change the wording a little bit or whether like the full on where you just stay it verbatim like on the road and nobody notices.
Right.
That's the ultimate joke thief.
Yeah.
The one who takes the joke and knows and does it on stage.
Do you think there's a lot of that happening at the professional level?
There's a lot more than I know about. I haven't seen it. Uh-huh. I haven't really seen it. But it's, I think it's more of a common thing that, you know, people who work the road a lot, they leave the cities, they do that. They add material to their set so they can go on headline on the road. And that is a common thing that I hear other people talk about more than I've actually seen myself.
Uh-huh.
But I do believe it exists.
Yeah.
But like what I try to talk about in the post is like, I'm trying to understand why people do that. They're just thinking about, I need to feed my family. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. If I tell this joke on the road and nobody back in a big city that matters notices, does it really matter? Whatever, you know, I mean, that's the lifestyle they want to lead.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, more people who are trying to become successful comedians in the public eye, are like, you know, writing some of the same premises that other people have. Like that's a different kind, you know, you can call them a hack, but it's different. It's different intentions.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't actually listen to a whole lot of comedy because I'm always worried that something's going to get stuck in the back of my head and then I'll forget like where I heard it or who I heard it from.
Totally.
And
it'll
just pop up and I'll say it on stage, you know.
Yeah.
That's the last thing I want
to
do.
And the thing is, like, you know, 20 years ago, you only had to listen to a few comedy albums and then you knew comedy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
20, 30 years ago. And now it's like you want to be familiar with everything everyone's ever said.
It's deep waters.
Yeah.
You know?
Like I did a joke on Conan O'Brien, a joke that I'd had for well over a year. And I was doing it in a lot of sets across America.
Uh-huh.
I put it on Conan, gets on YouTube. The next day, like, a few comments throughout the whole feed saying that's a Stephen Wright joke. That's a Stephen. Mm-hmm. The heaven and hell is a Stephen. It's the joke is I don't believe in heaven and hell because hot air rises. Just a one liner.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Mm-hmm. And they said there's a Steve Wright joke, and like a bunch of people said it. I looked it up. I couldn't find it anywhere. But these people who have seen Steve Wright's like fourth comedy special and are very familiar with it know about it. Yet nobody had told me throughout my whole time doing it. Nobody else knew. But finally, it was in that much of the public eye that a couple comedy snobs knew that it was somebody. I'm not listening to Steve Wright's specials.
Right.
And
then
I looked it up, and then I saw it transcribed. His joke is a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
It's like, if hot air rises, then shouldn't heaven be hotter than hell? Different. It's the same idea, just differently worded.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that in my life.
Yeah.
But we thought of something that linked something in science to religion.
Yeah.
You know, of course. Well, it would be crazy that nobody's ever else thought of it. You know what I mean?
And the weird part is,
but I'm being called a joke thief.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, what's his name? Leibniz and Newton both.
Leibniz and Newton.
Right? Didn't they both invent calculus or something? You know, I mean, one of those guys was probably calling the other guy a fucking hack from across.
Across
the English Channel or whatever. You know, it's just, I mean.
Well, what's crazy about the internet, too, is there's a whole culture of individuals who their sort of hobby is to try to, like, weed out, hack, like, joke thief, like, comics. It's weird. Like, just like how there's a whole culture of online people who, like, seek out, like, heckler videos and people, like, getting in arguments with hecklers or whatever. There's a whole culture of people that just want to, like, call other comics like hacks and joke thieves and like chase them down and whatever. And I can kind of understand some other comics getting emotional about it, but sometimes it seems a little like a little strange. Like maybe there's some therapeutic value to this that these people can do it, you know.
There's only so many comics out there, but there's a shitload of critics. There's critics everywhere. There's people online who want to judge art but not do it themselves. And there's every three of those people, there's one artist. You know what I mean? So the internet will always have that trolling and people trying to expose anything that they see unjust because they're critics. They consider themselves critics.
Well, that's another difference about, like you said, how comedy used to be. I mean, now you get a comedy video on YouTube and a million people can not only see it but also have the opportunity to comment on it anonymously. Where, you know, I mean, it changes the entire...
You know, I was talking with David Kerr about this and he brought up a good point because he said that he was putting... clips of his stand-up on YouTube and stuff, and then for club gigs they would put those clips on the internet, and he noticed that the crowd reaction was changing on those jokes because they had already seen the joke. So now he was like, now what I do is I kind of if I put something online, I cut it off before the final punchline so that they don't get the full joke, so it's not, you know, you sort of don't pop your bubble or whatever.
It's like giving a trailer to the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's also why some people, you know, they might post videos that aren't their act, but it might be a heckler video or just some crowd work. So you get a sense of this person as a comedian, but you're not burning your material, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird, it's a fine line, you know, because also, again, like back in the day when comedy wasn't very deep water, if you wanted to get your name out there, you had to put all your belongings in the trunk of your car and drive all over the country and do all of these little bar gigs and sideshow gigs. And
yeah, but it's changed in all kinds of ways. I mean, you know, I heard in the 80s, if you wanted to get booked for a gig, you could send a booker a spindle of cocaine. And you know, I mean.
Did you really hear that?
Yeah, someone told me that. Yeah.
I heard that comedy was fueled pretty heavily by cocaine in the 80s. I mean, it's. You could make an argument for
that. I think America
was the golden era.
America was fueled pretty heavily by cocaine in the 80s, I think.
Well, true, but I mean, I've heard stories, like you said, about comics getting paid in cocaine and, you know, the whole cocaine culture. And then sort of like when the cocaine bubble burst, I guess, it almost seems like now comedy clubs are all about beer. Like that's the new drug at the comedy clubs. You know, it's all about how much beer can we sell and how many people can we get in here to buy beers. And it's not so much about the comedy culture of the comedians as much as it is about what other products they can push out the door, you know. I don't want to bring you down.
Wow,
man,
saying, that
was
heavy,
man. Well, these are the things that keep me awake at night because I have far too much time on my hands. But yeah.
I have a question. So, Sammy, so for Conan, what was that experience like prepping for that and actually doing it? Were you nervous? Were you excited? What's your thoughts 5 minutes before when they give you the countdown, all that sort of stuff? What was?
Well, you want the unabridged version?
Yes.
So, you know, I had been waiting to get a TV appearance for a really long time. Like, I was just starving for it for years.
Was this your first?
Yeah, this was my first, like, real TV set. I did America's Got Talent in the middle of the streak, like, 2 years ago.
You got beat by the guy that plays the plastic buckets, is that correct?
I got beat by...
I don't think those shows are really designed for comedians. You know, some of the ones where you're... I mean, a nine-year-old girl who sings like an angel, I don't care how funny you are, that's going to be hard to beat.
The Dog Act won a couple of years ago,
but the
right?
that show, we had 90 seconds to do our bit. And then the next round we had 75. So I learned from that show how to tighten my jokes, and then I didn't even make it. I lost to Tom Carter, who's a very funny, experienced comedian, and his jokes are bullets.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. So after losing that, I went through my act and I just trimmed all this fat, trim, and then my stuff became more rapid fire. So I was ready for this.
Yeah.
And then I had a year. I was sending out tapes, and then. My friend got me a reference to Conan, and then we sent it to Conan, and didn't hear back. And this was like near the end of my streak, and I was really stressing out. I was going crazy, and the end of my streak, I was losing it. I wanted to quit comedy. I was like fucking. I lost it, and you know, didn't get the Conan thing, and I was like, fuck. I was like, nothing's working out. Everything. What all this other shit's happening? And then I bomb one night. I don't bomb. I just don't have a good set at the Hollywood Improv. And then I go home like, this is it. After I finish the streak, I'm fucking quitting comedy. I'm done.
Wow.
I open up my email. It's the booker from Conan. He's like, hey, man, really like your stuff. See that you're doing this 1,000 days thing. how would you like to perform on Conan at the end of it? And I was like, fuck yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Back in comedy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I started working my – I already kind of already knew what my set was. He already knew the booker of Conan's very specific about what he wants.
How much time did they give you?
4.5 to 5 minutes. He's very specific about what he wants, so he told me exactly what to keep. He passed the heaven and hell joke. You know what I mean? The booker of Conan would not let me go and rip off Stephen Wright if he knew. You know what I mean? My goal is just to tighten up the parts that aren't tight for the last, you know, I have like 50 days to prepare for this. 50 days, which I'm performing every night. You know, I have plenty of opportunities to work it. But I made some important discoveries like the night before. It's always how it works.
Yeah. Wow.
I made some important discoveries of my set the night before, which saved my set because that crowd on Conan is really hard. It's a tough crowd. I mean, they're cool when you crack them open, but they're a tough crowd to crack.
Do they not fire up the applause sign for you?
They do at the end. You'll get the applause at the end.
Who can we blame?
That's right, exactly. Where was the fucking sign?
But it went good. Yeah. So you made some important discoveries the night before and things went well?
Yeah, because so I was doing my college tour. I got back from that and I was in LA. I was working the set. And then meanwhile, I was doing all this press for the 1,000 Days thing. So I was just on the go. Mm-hmm. And when my publicist got me press with Playboy Radio. So the day before I'm doing Conan, I'm on Playboy Radio in Burbank, California, like 9 a.m. in the morning, and they have naked girls in front of me just doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And they're like, all right, now practice your Conan set while watching these naked girls. Like they had these like toys they were playing with. And so I did my set.
Like Tonka trucks and
stuff?
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, cool.
And so I did my 5 minutes and like.
So you did a set to three naked girls playing with toys?
Yes.
That sounds better than
my Conan
set,
actually. This was the morning before Conan, the day before. So I did it in front of them and like the casting people and the lighting, they were laughing and stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did my whole thing. And, you know, honestly, my set was not for that crowd. It was not for a Playboy. You know, I have raunchier stuff that they would much rather enjoy. But I'm doing my Conan set.
Yeah, your clean TV.
You know what I mean?
It's good that you have a naked chick set, though. That's a good thing to have in your comedy tool.
Yeah.
You know
she had a nice set. You know what I'm saying, guys? But what I'm saying is that it was very, like, I was put in all sorts of situations that helped me prepare, but I made some discoveries the night before where I was like, oh, yeah, kind of focus on this syllable here because, like, these little nuances that really. So
technical.
The next day. Yeah.
Technical stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I got a great sleep that night. The next day, woke up. I had all my friends come over to my apartment so we could do an open mic in my apartment with a little PA system because we've done that before. I did it when I was preparing for America's Got Talent. I had my friends pretend like they were Howard Stern, Sharon Osbourne, and Howie Mandel. And we like
so your three ugliest friends.
So I did
come
some
on
riffing.
Over.
Yeah, so I did riffing with them for like an hour like that. And when I did Vegas, like my set was not great. Or, I mean, it was good, but it wasn't enough. But my riffing with them was really good because I had practiced.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I learned that that's a really good thing to do. So I had my friends over, and I just ran my set. We did three takes. One where they don't laugh at all, just like complete silence. The first one was like I was like, look, just laugh naturally. Don't force laughs for me. Mm-hmm. Just laugh as you would. Mm-hmm. The next one, complete silence. And then the third one, laugh uncontrollably, walk over my punchlines. Mm. So the first one, like, you know, they did their natural laughs, and it was kind of not bad. Like, even with my friends who've seen me a bunch of times, you know, I was really into it. Second one was really tough. They just weren't laughing at all. It was just, they were so straight-faced. I was laughing because it was so scary.
Comedy can be awkward.
So it made me, it was weird because I was laughing and they were all just looking at me straight-faced. Uh-huh. And the third one, they all started laughing like crazy and I felt like a god. Like, it was so weird how we did that. And then I was ready to go. We got picked up by a town car. I took my posse. They let me take. I was like, "How many people can I bring in the room?" They said 7. I invited 7 people. I filled those slots.
Cool, man.
You know. And then we went there. We had catered food, massage chair. Just hung out backstage. You know, my name on the door.
Did they pay you for the Conan gig?
And my friends are just cracking jokes, and we're having a good time. It's just one of the best days, really. Yeah.
Do they pay you for the Conan gig?
They do, not a lot, but they pay you.
Nice.
So we're back there, and I'm just getting ready to go.
Staying loose.
They put makeup on you. Like, you have no choice. They put makeup on you, and my thing is though, when I get nervous, my mouth gets dry. I get the dry mouth. So like they had all these, that's like this fruit platter back. So I was like, fuck, like, because you never know. Like sometimes it's really hard to get rid of that dry mouth. So I brought grapes, I brought pineapples, I brought like all the different fruits that I could see. I brought water, I brought tea, and I took it like near the curtain because they're about to call me out. And I was like putting them all in my mouth, but like none of them were working. And I was like, fuck it, just surrender to the dry mouth. Yeah. Curtain opens, I walk out, I start doing my set, and it's like. The thing is that 3 months before this, I had had a dream that I was on Conan. Before I even knew I was getting booked on the show, I had a dream that I was on Conan, and I bombed, like, just the worst bombing ever. Like, I didn't remember my jokes. I did the wrong joke. Like, nobody's laughing. And then I remember the sound guy just telling me to get the fuck off stage.
Wow.
And then walking off and then waking up. This was like a year ago, and I had this dream. So I step out on stage, and then I'm suddenly taken back to the dream. But I'm, like, already starting my set. I'm, like, doing my set. I'm getting some laughs, but it's a tough crowd. It's tough to crack.
How many people are there?
Maybe, like, 150, 200.
And bleacher seating, right?
Bleacher
past
seating.
The cameras,
yeah, bleacher
and stuff.
Seating. And then right in front of you, there's kind of this dead space that they have for the cameras. Mm-hmm. And then the crowd's more like here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing my set. It's going okay. But, like, My desire was to get an applause break on my Palestinian joke, because that was the third joke that I told, and I was hoping if I get the applause break there, we'll move forward.
Yeah.
And then even better, my half-man, half-woman joke sometimes gets an applause, but I was hoping that it would, because then I'd have them on board, but it didn't. Like, neither of those did. That one didn't. The Palestinian one didn't. I did my God, that's what she said joke. That one didn't. And then I was like, fuck, what's going on? I do my surprise party joke. It goes okay, but it's like, shit. And I'm in my head thinking about the dream. And then all of a sudden, I just kind of snapped. I realized, like, this is your one chance.
Yeah.
You're going to just bomb here on national TV? This is your one chance, man. Stop fucking it up. And then all of a sudden, I kick in with this discovery that I had made the night before, which is, like, I do this, my surprise party joke. You know, it's I threw my friend Kyle a coming out party. It was a surprise party, but someone had to tell him. Mm. And then I have a tag where I say, they recently found the gay gene. Wranglers, extra small. Uh-huh. These are all jokes. Uh-huh. Before that, I'd been doing the joke like I've been saying. I'd been saying it like this. I've been saying, they recently found the gay gene. Wranglers, extra small. Just like super dry, super casual.
Uh-huh.
But then I was like, what if I just flipped it around and was like, they recently found the gay gene. Wranglers, extra small. And then so I did that, and the crowd, like Conan starts clapping.
Yeah.
And then when Conan starts clapping, the whole crowd follows.
Oh,
they're kind of like lemmings. They follow what Conan does.
Oh, so there's the trick. You got to get Conan.
Yeah, you have to get Conan's approval, and then that's how you win the crowd. So so all of a sudden, the whole crowd applauds, and then I'm like, I'm comfortable. Then I go into my last three jokes, which are my strongest ones, and they all get good responses.
Cool.
So. The set went good. It was like, you know, I rated myself as a 7 out of 10, given the circumstances, given everything.
So have you watched it, your set on Conan, since you've done it? Have you watched your own set?
Yeah, I watched it a bunch of times. The first times were, it was hard. It was your mind, if this is your first TV experience, your mind is trained to, like, especially after time where you tried, you there's points where you never thought it would come.
Yeah.
And seeing yourself on TV, your mind's like, this doesn't make – I've never been in a scenario like this before.
Yeah.
So it's weird watching yourself on TV. It's you. It's you on TV. But then after watching it a few times, you get a little more used to it.
Uh-huh. And, I mean, can you see all of this – all these things that you were thinking? Can you look back now? I mean, you know that happened, but just watching, would people be able to pick up that, wow, this guy's going through – all this brain activity is happening.
People who know me well,
some
people who know me well mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
My best friend said I sounded nervous in the beginning because he knows me really well. Whereas some people who don't know me that well were like, oh, you look confident the whole time.
Yeah.
Because they don't, but people can tell I'm a pretty subtle guy in general. So people who know me well know my little my subtleties. Yeah. So like my voice, you could tell by my voice that I was a little nervous, and that also that I wasn't just wasn't super present until that moment.
Huh.
Otherwise, you know, I the 1,000 days thing had given me the ability to appear in most situations like I wasn't fazed.
Yeah.
So I at least gave that kind of general image, like, you know, even if I'm not super confident about what's going on, I don't really give a shit.
Yeah.
Kind of aura. So, So the set ended up going good. Conan called me to the desk, which I didn't expect. And
did you have a little sit down on the air with him?
Not on air. Just we said goodbye at the end for me from the desk. So I was on TV at the late night desk.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool.
Step one.
Yeah.
I stuck my flag in there.
There you go.
What did you do the day after? What was your very next gig or performance?
The next day after Conan?
Yeah.
I headlined Cobbs in San Francisco.
Oh,
that's
not bad.
And it was such an interesting experience because I had to get there from L.A., and I do this thing called Zimride, which is like a ride share. And I looked up this guy, and his name was Harlan, and he, I met him in Los Angeles, and like I went to his house, he's an older guy, and I picked him up. He's there with his sister and like their family, and they're like, "We just saw you on TV last night. You were so funny. Like, we're so glad that he's going up with you." And it was just like, wow, like immediately.
Yeah.
And then I get to my show, and it hits me that all these people just saw me on TV last night. This was my day 999 special show.
Nice.
All my friends were there. And that's when it hit me. Oh, fuck, I can't do those jokes anymore. So I'm up there like, holy shit. You know, because it's just 5 minutes. But those 5 minutes is like the compacting of all the best shit that I have.
Yeah,
I mean, I took things. Those are things that I will scatter throughout my set.
Yeah.
You know, and taking them all out of the set makes a big difference. Like, I've adjusted now 6-7 months later, whatever. 6 months. Not even 6 months. But it took a long time to really just feel that loss, mourn that loss of your material, you know?
It's kind of a good problem to have, though. I've heard stories of people having their big moment, their big TV break or whatever, and then the very next day they're just like at a open mic in the basement of a hostel for three people, you know, and they're like, "I was just on TV last night."
Well, I will say that Cobbs
is anticlimactic.
Is a 400-seater, 450-seater, and about 100 people were there. So there was a little bit of that. So that was the show I did after that. But
what was your worst show doing this whole 1,001? Like, was there one particular show
that
just stuck out?
I don't know what to say because it's like there was.
Was it all good?
They were all bad in so many different ways. Like every show was bad in its own way. You know, there was something wrong with every
1,001 day nightmare.
Food wasn't good.
There, right? It couldn't have been
that
bad.
You know, it was the time I was punched in my stomach, but I wouldn't say that's bad because it's become one of the best stories.
Were you on stage and somebody just punched you?
Yeah, it was a really low stage.
It was also a midget, so
was he offended by a joke, or were you like?
I was at an Irish bar. And
His
story starts to make sense.
Yeah,
I get it now.
Need not to explain anymore. Basically, he got punched me in the stomach. He didn't really have a reason. But he thought we were still friends.
Well, you're the second comedian on our podcast series who has been assaulted while performing comedy.
Really?
You join
Jared Logan. That's right.
He's a very funny comedian out of New York City, I believe.
Isn't he he's the warm-up guy for Colbert, right?
Yeah, he does warm-up for the Colbert Report. And he'll be here actually in April.
Yeah. Nice.
He'll be coming back up. But I guess he was doing some bar show in New York.
Got bashed over the head with a beer bottle.
Yes. Or no, the dude took the microphone. Didn't the guy take the microphone hit him with it?
Yeah, that's right.
And then he had to replace the equipment that was broken. It's kind of fucked up. But, you know, it's unexpected, though. You never know what's going to happen. You know? It's weird. You know, in music, if you're like a rock star, you know, people throw panties at you or whatever, but
that
in comedy they throw beer glasses, or they just punch you in the stomach at an Irish bar,
or even worse, they just ignore you in silence and judgment. That's the worst part. Maybe I'm just speaking from personal experience there.
So was that your worst? We do a thing also, a worst road story. Is that your worst one?
No, it can't be. It really can't be. I've had so many bad.
Dig deep, Sammy. Dig deep.
Well, name a certain kind of pain, and I'll tell you when I experience
a certain kind of pain. You've run the gamut of pain, then.
Bombing in front of a crowd that is of a large enough size that you would think that wouldn't happen, and yet somehow.
Oh yeah, I forgot a handful of those. Well, there is an experience. This happened after the streak. Doesn't matter, right?
Whenever, yeah.
This was just about 2 months ago, actually. I was at Tommy T's in Pleasanton. I wrote a blog about this as well. Tommy T's is like my home club. And it was a large crowd, maybe 150 people. And like that's my home stage. But it was a tough crowd. They were angry. A lot of other things were going on. And some people were laughing, but like a lot of people were just dead silent. And then there was a point where boos started happening. The boos started happening after me being up there for about like 12 minutes and I wasn't doing so well. And then I said, well, guys, I got about 10 minutes up here more. And they're like, boo, boo, boo.
The natives are restless.
Yeah.
What did you do? Did you just keep going with your material or did you try to address it?
I kind of egged it on at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'd seen this, you know, a lot of comedians have seen this clip of Bill Burr.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Bombing and he just like in the Midwest. He's like, fuck you guys. I'm going to do my time. And he keeps doing it.
It's in like Philly, right? Yeah. Was that show they did with the Opie and Anthony tour?
Which is very inspiring. And it's like, okay, well, this is a moment that I'm going to have like that. But, you know, I'm aware that he did that. So I definitely want mine to be different. So I was not. Where Bill Burr was just cursing them out and telling them to fuck off.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to do my material.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do the material that I think this crowd would hate the most.
Punish them with your comedy.
Yes. And like Tommy T's, you know, bless it. It's one of my favorite places to perform. But the intelligence level there is not very high. So I started doing like all my higher brow.
More like Unpleasanton.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, folks.
Jokes that I've done before at Tommy T's and seen fail, so I knew they would fail here. So I know these are tried and failed jokes.
This is a great strategy.
These are tried and failed jokes. So I did them, and like they got more pissed off. They kept booing and booing. And then at the end, I twisted it and did jokes they would like, and like kind of started scraping some laughs out of them. It was so crazy because at the end of my set, I did like a joke they really liked, and like people were laughing in this way, like I was attacking them because they wanted to hate me. But then they started laughing, and I shot them with a bullet.
all that stored tension.
Yeah.
Well, that's the weird thing about that Burr tape too. It seems like towards the end, he's actually kind of winning them over, even though he's just
exactly,
going off.
Because
on
there's people in the crowd who respect that and like that. And there's people who are kind of just on the fuck him committed tip, you know.
But I think it's also part of human nature. Some people enjoy being, you know, and Philly strikes me as a place where they. You know, they don't respect you unless you tell them to go fuck themselves. And he sort of wins them over with his standoffishness. They recognize that.
Yeah. Well, it takes balls, you know. I mean, that's it. I mean, a lot of people, no matter how pissed off they get, they can probably still respect the fact that they could never be up on that stage.
I just like that clip because, you know, he's telling them to go fuck themselves. And then he's like, I will be selling my DVDs after the show. 6 minutes left.
6 minutes
left. He does the whole countdown.
That's pretty funny.
Man. All right.
So, Sammy, your comedy CD on iTunes, right? Get Funny or Die Trying. That's the Are you in the process of maybe putting another one of those out, or
I'm not like planning it extensively right now, but it's I'm just working on material to put on that next album, and eventually do it.
Did you go through a record deal for that, or just sort of release independently?
I have a guy who we just kind of made our own. Entity, and we just got it on iTunes and stuff.
That's the way to go, man. I mean, you know, like Macklemore, him and that dude that produced his stuff, they don't have a record label or whatever, so the majority of that money they get, which is pretty rare for music or comedy. I mean, you know, because a lot of comedy record deals are kind of like 50s blues musicians record deals, you know? I mean...
Well, it's really all about having the resources to just get a good quality sounding recording. I mean, that's 90% of the battle. If you can walk away from a gig with a good high quality recording, I mean, you know, you can put that up on iTunes or anywhere else, and you don't need to kind of go through distributors and everybody else. I mean, Louis C.K. with the classic example, obviously he paid a lot of money and had a lot of production in his album that he released on his website, but still he made a killing doing that.
Yeah.
And I don't think he had
it's
to pay
the new
anybody.
Trend.
Yeah.
DIY.
Yeah. Independent. Mm-hmm. Indie.
That's the way to go. Rogan did the same thing, I think. But, you know, you kind of have to have a following, too. I'd put a CD up there, and, you know, I'd probably make a good $3.50. So that would be huge.
Yeah, royalties, man. Baby. They're coming in.
Yeah. Pandora.
Are you on satellite radio? Do you get your stuff on Sirius XM and
I got
that
some
sort of
things
thing?
That appear every now and then.
I find that's helpful, you know, and it's also good exposure, too. I remember, you know, just listening to different satellite radio and getting a chance to hear people that were sort of outside of my prior wheelhouse, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Your prior wheelhouse?
You just I have several wheelhouses. Prior? And
prior being the main one.
You trolling me on the podcast, man?
No, I was thinking maybe you were saying, like, I was just imagining you listening to Richard Pryor, like, 24 hours a day. Like, that's the only thing, like, you'll listen to is just Richard Pryor.
That, which is true for
the
safest
bet.
No, that does describe an early part of comedy for me, you know?
You got all
I remember
Pryor
buying all those old Richard Pryor albums, you know, Craps After Hours, and I thought they were all bootlegs, but they're actually that David Drozen Uproar Records, part of his catalog. Which they're pretty great, you know.
Richard
Pryor was amazing,
man.
I like a lot of early stuff.
Man.
It's got that kind of. I like a lot of the old stuff, even the old Red Fox. You know, you can hear like dishware crinkling, and it's got just a real
Red Fox.
It's
recently,
got a real old
man.
School feel to it. That's pretty great.
Yeah, when I was growing up in Indiana, I was like listening to all those Eddie Murphy albums too, and everybody thought I was a maniac out there in the cornfields of Indiana listening to that stuff, but. It's good stuff. Do you have any comics that you really, you know, kind
of... Who are some of your faves?
Yeah.
I like the a lot of open micers, like guys who have been doing it for years and never made it. Those are my fans. and MC, you know, like, people always ask, you know, who I like. I mean, like, I think the first comic that really influenced me or that struck me as wow, gave me that wow feeling, was Chris Rock. Yeah. I'd seen stand up to that point, but I was 15, and I saw Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker, and the way he addressed all these crazy social issues that were going on at the time, Monica Lewinsky, gun control, the Columbine thing, like all these crazy things that were happening in 1999, and he hit the nail on the head on all of them, and I was so blown away by that. And that was the first time I was like, wow, about comedy. So I think Chris Rock kind of influenced me in that regard.
Uh-huh.
When Chappelle became a big hit, I just thought he was so funny. I just thought he was just so naturally funny.
Yeah.
So I was definitely influenced by him. And then I started watching comedy to like when I started doing it. And then I became, you know, I found all these other comics that I liked. But then it was just like too many. It was like overkill.
Yeah.
So now my fans are like local comedians or just people who I like a lot that work alongside on the same level or like new comedians. Those are my comedy crushes.
Yeah.
But like, you know, one of my all-time favorites is my friend from back at the open mics in San Fran, the Bay Area. I was, you know, when I was a new kid, nobody would really pay attention to me and nobody was like befriending me. This guy, he was nice to me and we started carpooling to gigs together. He was like my first friend. And he's the guy who's been doing it for like 15 years just doing the open mics. And just, like, bombing a lot because he does this weird act, like this crazy thing. But I love it. It's like I die every time I watch it. And he was, like, my first friend. So he's I'm like a fan, you know?
Huh.
So that's how fanship works with me. But
so he goes up and bombs routinely, and that's...
Oh, I love... I mean, I love watching bombing. Like, if you can bomb... You know,
bombing is an art.
Bombing is an art. And like, because some bombs just destroy in here. I love it. It's just so funny.
I wouldn't say I'd love it, but sometimes, you know.
Who can fail the funniest?
Well, sometimes when you feel it coming on, when you know it's not working, when you know it's going, sometimes it is nice to just try to embrace it and like figure out how to like just, you know, all right, I'm going to do a belly flop, but you know, maybe I can still be entertaining as I go down in flames.
Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes you can just feel it. As soon as you get up there, you're like, this isn't good. This
yeah,
is
yeah.
Or something's off.
Yeah, you can feel it.
So, Sammy, then I have to ask you then, Andy Kaufman, genius or just loser?
Oh.
And is he really dead?
Has to be one.
Answer all the important
questions.
Well,
I'm not saying
I would say genius.
Yeah.
Because it seems like people are one way or the other. Nobody's like, yeah, he's okay. I could take it or leave it. Everybody seems like they either love him or they hate him. And
no,
if you're a fan of this guy who bombs routinely, that kind of Andy Kaufman was...
He was a genius, and he was very talented. The thing is, there's people like Andy Kaufman nowadays, but they're not as talented as he was. He could do voices. He could do characters.
Yeah.
And he bombed, you know, in style.
Dude, there's a great... I think one of Marin's podcasts, he's interviewing someone who's an old-school New Yorker guy. Who used to go to the old improv when Bud Friedman first turned it into a club versus a cabaret. And I guess that's when Andy Kaufman first started going down. And he's got this great story about how he basically would – he was conning people. He'd come in and as this act. Even before he got on stage, he was doing his act.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
It's a trip to listen to these stories about him.
Yeah, well, you know, because I've talked to other people. Like, I – got in a long argument with Ari Shaffir once about he was like just angry, just like couldn't like.
So he has the opposite. He doesn't like Andy Kaufman.
Oh, hated him. Hated father. There's really? No reason, no purpose, no like. You know, it was flabbergasted that I even like found it entertaining. You know, so well, you either love him or you hate him. Really, I think.
Yeah. I'm on the fence.
You are.
I mean, I like the movie, The Man on the Moon or whatever. And
yeah, the romanticized version. I don't know. Have you seen Tony Clifton? I think that's what really clinched it for me was this Tony Clifton.
The live act of Tony Clifton?
Well, that and just the whole, like, persona. Like you said, this guy was a method actor. Like, he would get fully into it. And, I mean, the guy didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He was vegetarian, practiced meditation.
And he died of cancer.
Yeah.
See,
well, but this Clifton
happens?
Character, he would
see
drink and smoke
nonstop.
See what happens
when you try to live a healthy lifestyle?
Yeah.
Your cells begin to replicate uncontrollably. All right. Well, I think it's been a good little chat. What do you think, Joe? Voodoo Chicken?
Yeah. Sammy, you got anything you want to plug? Any upcoming appearances? Any
we'll try to
where's our fan base located?
On the internet.
Yeah.
What city is Seattle?
Well, you're in Seattle now.
I'm going to be at Seattle Underground tonight, 8 and 10:30. Come out, or you can just follow me
on
Twitter or Instagram. Anything, Sammy Obeid, SammyObeid, and you know, just keep coming out and supporting.
Do you tweet a lot? Are you a big Twitterer?
Not really.
But follow me anyway.
You know, support what you see.
Yeah.
If you see something, say something.
Isn't that like the New York subway? Like
that's the New York
right
subway
there?
Rule, and it's all I took it
it's
into my own
applicable.
Personal philosophy.
It's also the comedy rule. See something, say something.
Cool.
All right. Well, you heard it there. You heard it here first. SammyKO.com is the website and the blog. Get Funny or Die Trying is the album on iTunes. You can follow him on Twitter. You can see him here tonight if for some insane reason you happen to hear this between now and the next few hours from now. I'm Joe Hicks. I'd like to thank Sammy for joining us tonight. I'd like to thank James, my co-host.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
That's a Tight 60 podcast, and we're out.